Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio. Unplug, strap yourself in, because you are about to move beyond the matrix.
You've actually landed beyond the matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. So glad to see you and to hear from you. We have just had an exciting week, a lot of things going on, have a great show for you. We want to remind you that today's show, and as well as for the next few weeks, we have an official sponsor for Beyond the Matrix, and it is the Torah Learning Channel. TorahLearningChannel.com, your unique source for live streaming 24 hours a day, kosher Torah learning. Watch it today at TorahLearningChannel.com. You will not regret it. Jerry, we have an exciting show. We have a great guest lined up. And today is going to be sort of a what we call a retro Holocaust lesson for the 21st century. And the reason why you and I are bringing this up is some alarming statistics that we read about about millennials and a lot of Americans today that just don't either know anything about the Holocaust or they're ambivalent about it.
Yeah, on Yom HaShoah, a group called the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany issued the findings of a Holocaust awareness survey here in the United States, and they were pretty devastating. 7 out of 10 Americans say fewer people seem to care about the Holocaust than they used to. A majority of Americans, 58%, believe something like the Holocaust could happen again. And in fact, we know in places like Sudan and other places in Africa, it has.
Right.
Nearly one third of all Americans, 31%, and more than 4 in 10 or 41% of the millennials believe that substantially less than 6 million Jews were killed during the Shoah. Then if you ask them about a Holocaust death camp like Auschwitz-Birkenau, you know, 45% couldn't name a single one.
Now, when we come back from the break, we're going to be actually expanding this out a little bit more and then introducing you to a guy by the name of Rafael Medoff, who is going to sort of join in with his perspective on a book that he wrote about FDR, the Second World War, and why wasn't more done to help during that horrendous period in Jewish history. So listen, you don't want to tune out. Matter of fact, go during the break, grab something, come back, get you a cup of tea, sit down, and enjoy the show. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio.
There was a time you didn't worry about terrorism. It was something that happened in a faraway place or to someone else. But now you want to know. Now you want to understand. Now you're afraid that you might be in the danger zone. You need to listen to Gadi Edelman on The Danger Zone every week, where you will find out the truth about what is going on in the world around you. Gadi Edelman on The Danger Zone, right here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
As we promised you, we are back with a segment called Holocaust Lesson for the 21st Century. We just talked about some statistics that were compiled a couple of weeks ago, that shows that millennials are less educated about the Holocaust than other people have in the past. And were there any other statistics, Jerry, that you were wanting to mention you didn't mention? I can't remember if you had a couple extra things.
Basically, 11% of U.S. adults and over a fifth of millennials, 22%, haven't heard or not sure they even know about the Holocaust. Mm. But 93% of the respondents said, gee, they'd like to have students learn more about it.
Well, we want to educate our listener and help them to remember the powerful lesson of the Holocaust. It's not just cut and dry. It's very complex, and especially on the issue that we have with the government that was in power with FDR, the president, and Congress and Senate. What was their disposition toward the Jewish cause during that time. So we have an interesting guest. I want to have Jerry go ahead and do the introduction.
Yes, our guest is Dr. Raphael Medoff. He is director of the David S. Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies in Washington, D.C. He is the author or co-author of 19 important works on the subject we're about to address today.
What's important that we hit a tone that helps people to understand why it's important to learn these facts. Now, I was heartened by the fact that just read an article from the El Paso Times that the 11th ADA Brigade and Air Defense Brigade has made a post-wide push to have Holocaust remembrance, like put at the top of the list on the military installation. It made me really feel good. And it's happening across the country and the world. We're not trying to just point out the bad, but folks, we're here to remind you there are a lot of people that just don't know that this actually took place or even know the details. So let's go with the first guest, Jerry.
Raphael, the late David S. Wyman was the author of a number of works, but one of the seminal articles he talked about was why wasn't Auschwitz bombed? And now suddenly it's been reignited in terms of the controversy. I wonder if you could tell our audience about what has occurred in remarks by a staffer at the U.S. Memorial Holocaust Museum.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a strange controversy that's happening with the U.S. Holocaust Museum because it is a federal government-sponsored institution, which does a lot of very important work in terms of educating the public about the Holocaust. And the public, in a sense, trusts the Holocaust Museum to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So when it comes to the issue of the refusal of the Roosevelt administration to bomb either the gas chambers and crematoria at Auschwitz or the railway lines leading to that death camp, it's surprising and disappointing that a staff historian at the Holocaust Museum should be in effect making excuses for the fact that President Roosevelt and his administration refused to bomb Auschwitz.
Let's look for a second about the excuses. That's really important. What were the excuses or what was said in passing that appears to be sort of like, well, this is the reason why it couldn't be done?
Well, this historian at the Holocaust Museum, whose name is Rebecca Erbelding, was quoted in the Israeli press this week as saying that had the U.S. Bombed Auschwitz, then many of the prisoners themselves might have been killed. And she offered this as a kind of a rationalization for why the Roosevelt administration didn't attack the camp. But it's a very poor excuse for several reasons. First of all, it's not even the reason at the time that the Roosevelt administration refused to bomb Auschwitz. The U.S. government officials received many requests from Jewish organizations in 1944 to either bomb the gas chambers or to bomb the railways. They never said, the government officials never said, we're not going to bomb Auschwitz because some of the prisoners might be killed. It would have been an absurd response because by 1944, it was well known that 12,000 Jews were being gassed every single day in Auschwitz. So the idea of not bombing it because some people might be killed, when you know that they were being killed constantly every day, clearly was preposterous. So she's making an excuse that was not even relevant at the time. The second thing that's really absurd about giving that as the reason or as a reason is that the survivors themselves, Auschwitz inmates themselves, were praying for the Allies to bomb the camp. Elie Wiesel, in his famous book Night, talks about how he and other slave laborers who were in the area a few miles from the gas chambers saw the American planes bombing in the slave labor areas because there were German synthetic oil factories situated there. And they were considered a military target, so the Allies bombed those sites but didn't hit the gas chambers and crematoria that were just a few miles away. And Wiesel writes in his book that he and the other prisoners rejoiced, even though they knew that the bombs could kill them, because of course they knew they were doomed to be murdered anyway in the days ahead. And so they were just praying that the Allies finally were coming to destroy or at least interrupt the mass murder process.
Raphael, what was the feasibility of possibly bombing these killing centers in terms of the Allies' capabilities at the time we're talking about in 1944?
Well, when requests were made to the War Department in the spring, summer, and fall of 1944, the Jewish organizations that asked for bombing received what was essentially a form letter, because almost every one of these letters had the exact same wording. It came from the Assistant Secretary of War, John McCloy, in which he said that the War Department had carried out a study of the feasibility of this idea of bombing the railways or the camp, and they had concluded that it was impracticable. That was his word. He said because it would require the diversion of American bombers from other parts of Europe and taking them away from the war effort in order to carry out an attack that was not related to the necessities of the war. But that claim was false. And we know now that no such study had ever been undertaken. Many historians have gone through all the relevant archives, and no evidence has ever been found that they did a study. In fact, the War Department and the rest of the Roosevelt administration had already made a decision in principle not to expend even the most minimal resources on a humanitarian objective such as bombing Auschwitz, even though American planes already were bombing in the area. So on the one hand, you have the Assistant Secretary of War saying planes would have to be diverted, so therefore it would undermine the war effort. Very same time, as Elie Wiesel testified, American planes were bombing in areas within a few miles of the gas chambers and crematoria. So clearly, this diversion argument was a total fake. And so there's no doubt it would have been feasible, but it would have required President Roosevelt to recognize that it was worth sparing a few bombs and a few minutes from the planes that were flying over Auschwitz and very close to Auschwitz.
I had two personal testimonies to that for the benefit of you and listener audience. A friend of mine was the lead navigator for General Ira Eaker's aircrafts that were flying in the 15th 8th Air Force at the time. They were bombing the synthetic gas or oil plant at the Buna Monowitz Works about 5 miles away. He told me that basically they used the four crematorium as visual aiming points on their final bomb runs, and therefore it was visually fairly easy to do that, and there was no significant flak cover at the time. My late brother-in-law was involved with Operation Frantic, which secunded a couple of squadrons of B-17s that were based in western Ukraine less than 120 miles away. So there was absolute feasibility about doing that stuff. And
A few years back, the David Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies, of which I'm director, learned that former U.S. Senator and presidential candidate George McGovern had been one of the pilots who flew over Auschwitz in 1944 on some of these bombing runs targeting the oil factories. And we sent a camera crew out to South Dakota to interview McGovern about his experiences. And he confirmed that that he and his crew could have, just from the point of view of technical feasibility, they certainly could have targeted the gas chambers or the crematoria. They also could have targeted the railroad lines over which Jews were being deported and the bridges. He said there was never a guarantee of success, of course. When they bombed railway lines, the Germans, repaired them in a matter of days. But that didn't stop the Allies from continuing to bomb railway lines, throughout the war. And that's because it was certainly a part of military strategy. So in the case of the railway lines, even disrupting them for a couple of days until they were repaired would have saved many lives, considering the thousands were being gassed daily. Bridges took longer to repair. So if McGovern and his crew had been given the orders to hit bridges, that could have even more seriously disrupted the mass murder process. McGovern, of course, was a great admirer of Franklin Roosevelt. He called him his hero. He said, but even heroes sometimes have their flaws. And he said, in this case, clearly President Roosevelt had two great flaws. One was the mass internment of Japanese Americans without legitimate basis for believing that they were spies. And the second was the refusal to bomb Auschwitz when it clearly was feasible.
That is actually where I want to go in the next segment, is to really examine what was behind this. Was it because FDR himself was an anti-Semite? Did he have just a lot of pressure on him within his cabinet, etc.? Because this is really a curious fact for me that I would like to figure out, because this is not really well known by the general public. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everyone. This is Andrea Simintow from Jerusalem, inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together, we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simintow, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Back from the break. Remember, we are sponsored by TorahLearningChannel.com, and you got to watch it today. Try it at TorahLearningChannel.com. It is your unique source for live streaming 24-hour days kosher Torah learning. Jerry, let's take off on the rest of this interview.
Dr. Medoff, who was David S. Wyman? What is his legacy? And how important is it in this discussion about what the U.S. response was during the Holocaust?
You know, in the first years after World War II, most of the American public assumed that President Roosevelt must have done whatever he could have to help Jews during the Holocaust. Because, of course, he was someone who was known as a great humanitarian, championing of the forgotten man. Nobody could have imagined that there would have been opportunities to rescue innocent people that he would have turned down. And that was the conventional wisdom until Professor David Wyman, the grandson of two Protestant ministers, wrote his first book, 1968, called Paper Walls. And the title alludes to the huge amount of bureaucracy and unnecessary regulations and extra requirements that the Roosevelt administration imposed on Jewish refugees who were fleeing from the Nazis and wanted to come to the United States. So the book explored how even though America had a very strict immigration system in those days, it was a quota system where there was a limited number of people who could come from each country. But even though it had that tight system, the Roosevelt administration made it much worse by creating these paper walls, as he called them, to make it as difficult as possible for Jewish refugees to get permission to come into America. And as a result, the quota from Germany was almost never filled. During Roosevelt's 12 years in office, the quota from Germany, which was 27,000 per year, was filled only 1 year. And the other years, most of those other years, it was not even 25% filled. Unused quota places did not carry over to the next year. So if they weren't filled, they were gone. Altogether, there were 190,000 unused quota places from Germany and later from Axis-occupied countries. That's 190,000 Jewish refugees who could have been saved from the Holocaust without changing America's laws, without changing the immigration system in any way. So Professor Wyman's findings in that book were a shock. But the even greater shock to the American public came some years later when he published his 1984 bestseller, The Abandonment of the Jews. The title really sums up, of course, his conclusion, which is that President Roosevelt and his administration had many opportunities to rescue Jews from the Holocaust, opportunities that would not have involved any conflict with the war effort, would not have involved any great political risk, but which the president and his State Department deliberately refused to take advantage of.
You know, I have considered what you've said here with a tremendous amount of weight. I would have assumed if someone would have asked me why the president made such a strong paper wall and made it impossible for Jews to come to the United States, would have been maybe a counter, counterintelligence issue, and that the concern for bringing Jews or Germans over would cause a problem. But you're telling me that there's no research that even says or shows that that was a concern with these people.
Well, the fear of Nazi spies was a very real fear in the United States in the lead up to World War II. But let's go back a little bit, because the period we're talking about starts in 1933.
Right, right.
That's when Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. That's when the persecution of the German Jews began. And that's also the year that Franklin Roosevelt became president, began his first term, 1933. So mm-hmm. At that point, the issue of Nazi spies was not a problem or a concern.
Mm.
And yet only 5% of the quota for Germans was filled in that year. A tiny handful of German Jews came in. So it was not because of the issue of Nazi spies. Now, it goes without saying that the United States at that point was experiencing the Great Depression, and many people were opposed to immigration because they were afraid that refugees would come and take away jobs from American citizens, that there would be a burden on American society. But again, we're not talking about making a special law to allow in refugees or taking any special action. We're only talking about the existing immigration quotas. So in order to take in more Jewish refugees, President Roosevelt did not have to go to Congress. He didn't have to have some big fight on Capitol Hill. He didn't have to start a big public controversy that would have been politically risky for him. All he had to do was quietly instruct his administration, the State Department in those days was in charge of this. So all he had to do was quietly tell the State Department, allow the quotas to be filled in accordance with the existing law. It wouldn't have even been well publicized. Most people would not even have known that the quotas were being filled. But again, it would not have involved any political risk. And yet President Roosevelt refused to do that. On the contrary, his administration made every effort to reduce the number of Jews coming to the country to as little as possible. Far, far below what the law actually allowed. Now, the conventional wisdom for many years regarding the question of immigration was that President Roosevelt wasn't willing to take steps to allow in more refugees because it would have been politically risky. And that's what, you know, that's what people generally assume. But in fact, as we've seen, it could have been done within the existing laws. So that leaves a question which historians have never really answered adequately, and that is, so why not just let them in according to the law? The conventional excuses about fear of Nazi spies or about the political risks, they don't actually apply to the events that happen. So that was the question. If you look at most histories of the period, nobody really talks about Roosevelt's personal feelings about Jews. And that's understandable, because presidents typically make policy decisions not based on their personal feelings, but based on political calculations and other factors. And yet personal sentiments can sometimes color a president's decisions. And that's why it is important to look at what President Roosevelt said about Jews privately.
And that would be interesting to hear that now. Jerry, did you have something you want to say first?
Yeah, I did. You mentioned the State Department, and probably one of the most virulent opponents of opening up the U.S. to Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany and elsewhere in the Axis was a person by the name of Breckinridge Long. Who was he? And how bad was he?
Breckinridge Long was Assistant Secretary of State in the Roosevelt administration beginning in 1940. Prior to that, he had served as the U.S. ambassador to Italy, where he got himself into trouble because he kept praising Mussolini. And he was one of the ones who was infamous for saying that the trains in fascist Italy were very punctual. Because of that controversy, Roosevelt brought him back to Washington, but then promoted him, made him Assistant Secretary of State, in charge of numerous divisions in the State Department, including the Visa Division. So that made Breckinridge Long the most important official in the government for implementing Roosevelt's policies regarding refugees. Long was an extreme restrictionist. He was also unabashedly anti-Semitic. I say unabashedly, meaning that in his private diaries, which later came out, he made unquestionably anti-Semitic remarks. Of course, he was too sophisticated to ever voice such sentiments in public. But we know now that those were in fact his sentiments. But it's very important to remember, Breckinridge Long did not make his own immigration policy. He was there, as were all of the State Department officials, to implement the president's policy. And it was President Roosevelt's policy to suppress Jewish immigration to the lowest levels possible. And Breckinridge Long was very effective at doing that. I mentioned earlier the question of Roosevelt's own private sentiments about Jews. And it's only in the last 6 or 7 years that a number of historians, including myself, have uncovered evidence about what the president was saying about Jewish refugees, about Jews, back in the 30s and 40s. And one of the fascinating things that that I found was how similar his fears, his private fears and paranoia about Jews, were to his fears and attitudes towards Asians. And I mentioned this because there was some interesting research done on the motives for the president's decision to intern the Japanese Americans. And now we know from articles that Roosevelt wrote in the 1920s that he had extremely racist views of Asians, that he felt Japanese were disloyal and could never be assimilated, never become fully loyal Americans. He wrote articles saying that whites and Orientals, as he called them, should never marry, because you should not try to mix their blood. And that kind of sentiment helped lead him to being willing to intern 120,000 people without any basis. His writings about Jews, his comments about Jews in private that we've uncovered in recent years, show a similar pattern of paranoia. His view that Jews could not easily assimilate, that they couldn't be trusted, that if you let them concentrate in one area of the country or in your economy or culture, that they would try to dominate it, and that Jews tended to be a dangerous kind of element to have in your country. And it seems clear now that that was one of the reasons he wanted to keep Jewish refugee immigration to as low a level as possible.
This is something that, you know, in the 21st century, we look back on and forget that this country very much in its politics and its sort of natural cultural proclivity was very racist and biased and bigoted. And so we'll be back after the break. We'll talk more here with Dr. Mehta.
I'm John O'Vandor.
And I'm Ross Nichols.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind, a show that broadcasts all the weekly goodness that flows like milk and honey from the Holy Land straight into your ears with humorous and happy news stories.
We're going to be talking about...
What are we going to talk about?
A person who takes out a terrorist with a pizza tray.
And there's Donald Trump talking to a turkey. What's that about?
A 71-year-old rock star is a staunch supporter of Israel.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind,
every Thursday.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
We're in the final segment of Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. Thank you for taking time to listen. We'd like to hear from you. If you wouldn't mind, drop us an email, rod@israelnewstalkradio.com, rod@israelnewstalkradio.com. Dr. Madoff, we were discussing about FDR's apparent anti-Semitism, and it wasn't just anti-Semitism. It had to do with his racial views, period. Give us a little bit more detail on that so that we can look at the evidence behind it. It's not just a statement.
There was a lot of anti-Semitism in the 1930s, and there's a lot of anti-Semitism today. but American citizens have a right to expect more of their elected leaders.
Right.
We expect them to hold to a higher standard. And that's why it was very disturbing when I and colleagues of mine found in recent years a number of statements that President Roosevelt made privately about Jews. For example, boasting proudly how when he was on the board of trustees at Harvard, he helped impose a quota on the admission of Jewish students because they didn't want too many Jews at Harvard. He in one conversation with a U.S. senator in 1939, he said how proud he was that he had no Jewish blood in his veins. We found a number of conversations in which he talked about how you don't want to have too many Jews in any one particular country or one particular region because then they'll try to dominate everything. So he had an attitude that was very, very disturbing by our standards, but also disturbing, of course, to many people at the time. Because, yeah, there was a lot of anti-Semitism in those days, but there were a lot of people who were not anti-Semitic. And it was, and certainly by the 1930s, 1940s, it was not considered to be a to be a reasonable, civilized position to hate other people because of their race or religion, or to want to keep them out of the country just because they're from a different ethnic group. The significance of Roosevelt's private statements about Jews is this. It helps us to understand several important things that Roosevelt did regarding the Holocaust that don't have any other clear explanation. We've talked about how he suppressed Jewish refugee immigration to levels far below what the law allowed. There's no logical explanation for that, except that his vision of America was an America that was that should be overwhelmingly white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, and would not have too many Jews in it. His decision, or the administration's decision, his and the other departments in the administration to never expend even the slightest amount of resources on, for example, interrupting the mass murder process at Auschwitz. It doesn't really make any sense when we know that there were American planes bombing the oil factories just a couple of miles from the gas chambers. How do we explain this? And again, knowing that Roosevelt felt this way privately about Jews and that he did not want to have a lot of Jewish refugees on his hands, because he didn't want pressure to bring them to America, that helps in part to explain what otherwise are really, frankly, inexplicable decisions that he made in the course of what Professor Wyman so aptly called the abandonment of the Jews.
Dr. Medoff, there were a couple of conferences, one in 1938 in France at Evian and one in 1943 that occurred just about the same time as the Wausau Ghetto uprising in Bermuda. What were they concerned with, and how devastating were the results of those conferences?
These two conferences were Roosevelt's grand gestures, his attempt to give the impression that his administration was genuinely concerned about helping Jews who were fleeing from the Nazis, but without actually taking any concrete steps. The first of these conferences, the Evian Conference held in France in the early summer of 1938, brought together representatives of 32 countries. But not one of those countries, with the unusual and surprising exception of the Dominican Republic, not one of the other countries was willing to open its doors to Jewish refugees. In the case of the Dominican Republic, they offered to take in 100,000 Jews from Nazi Germany. But it was the Roosevelt administration that discouraged them because it didn't want a large influx of Jewish refugees so close to America's southern border. After the conference was over, one critic noted sarcastically that the word Evian spelled backwards is naive. And he said it was naive of anyone to think that the Western democracies had any genuine interest in trying to solve this terrible humanitarian catastrophe. So that was 1938. That was before the onset of the mass murder of the Holocaust. The second conference to which you alluded was held in Bermuda in 1943. That was an Anglo-American conference. It was just the governments of the United States and Great Britain. Its main purpose was to try to deflect the growing public pressure and criticism in the United States of the Roosevelt administration's failure to do anything to help the Jews. And when I say growing criticism, I don't mean there was a mass movement, but there was a growing amount of criticism in the press and within the Jewish community about the fact that Jews were being massacred by the hundreds of thousands and then by the millions, and yet the Roosevelt administration seemed completely unconcerned. So for 12 days, U.S. and British delegates conferred on the island of Bermuda. They selected Bermuda as the site for the conference specifically in order to try to keep away the press and keep away Jewish organizations and possible protesters. At the conference, they didn't come up with any concrete plans to help the Jews for the same old reasons. The Roosevelt administration was not willing to admit more refugees to the U.S. The British government did not want to open the doors to Palestine because of Palestinian Arab violence and opposition to Jewish immigration. So Palestine's doors were closed. America's doors were almost completely closed. And therefore, at the end of their 12 days, the Bermuda delegates emerged essentially empty-handed. And it was that failure, the failure of the Bermuda Conference, which really galvanized many segments of the American Jewish community to come out for the first time and publicly challenge the Roosevelt administration. This was quite a surprising development because, as we know, American Jews were overwhelmingly supportive of President Roosevelt, gave him more than 90% of their votes each mm-hmm. time he ran for re-election. But by the summer and the fall of 1943, President Roosevelt's abandonment of European Jews had become so blatant that a growing number of American Jews were willing to publicly criticize and challenge the president and to urge him to do something in the final months of the war to rescue at least some of the Jews.
Dr. Madoff, this is awfully disturbing to hear again, but where do we go from here? We have about, 4.5 minutes or less. Probably we're at 4 minutes right now. What would you say to our listeners? How can we make sure that this is not repeated again? What do we need to do as a society to preserve the right, just way of living for people in the nations?
The Holocaust was not the last genocide. It seems every generation has encountered either genocide or mass atrocity somewhere in the world. Starting in the 1970s, we saw Cambodia, and then subsequently Rwanda, and of course Darfur, in the Balkans, ethnic cleansing in the 90s. In recent years, mass killings in Syria, not genocide, but still atrocities on an extraordinary level. The response of the United States government has been very mixed to each of these genocides. It's clear that that our leaders have not completely learned the lessons of the 1940s. In the case of Cambodia and Rwanda, so the Carter and Clinton administrations, they did literally nothing to intervene. In the Balkans, the Clinton administration did belatedly intervene, and it showed how the use of American air power could stop mass killing. In Syria, we've seen two very different policies. We saw President Obama's policy of threatening to take action against the use of chemical weapons, but then not doing it. And then more recently, we've seen on two occasions the current administration using American military force to hit those Syrian chemical weapons sites. Of course, a preemptive policy would have solved a lot of the problems we're facing now. And it had, just as if Western leaders had taken action against Hitler in the 1930s, there never would have been a Holocaust.
Right.
If the West had taken serious action against Assad just a few years ago, you wouldn't have millions of Syrian refugees flooding out of the country and causing this terrible international refugee crisis. So the key lesson, I think, is for the free world to act preemptively, not to wait until a dictator is engaged in mass murder or chemical weapons or other atrocities, but to take early and substantial action in order to preempt the possibility of genocide.
And look, I think another thing that would help is for people to educate themselves. How can someone find your website, purchase your book, etc., so that they can inform themselves and be more responsible, I guess, in the world they live?
Our website is www.wymaninstitute.org. That's Wyman, W-Y-M-A-N, institute.org. And on our website, you'll find a number of very helpful resources, including the only online encyclopedia of America's response to the Holocaust. And you'll see our publications for sale, including our latest book, which is called Too Little and Almost Too Late, The War Refugee Board and America's Response to the Holocaust. That book and many other publications, including Professor Wyman's famous book, The Abandonment of the Jews, are all available at WymanInstitute.org.
I really appreciate the time that you've taken to be with us today, especially on this time in which we still see anti-Semitism. There is racism that still goes on in the world. We would like to have a world in which none of this exists. We see slavery, for example, that has taken place in North Africa. God forbid that we could, as a society, ignore the plight of people being tortured and murdered and killed. Keep informed, stay informed, and also keep listening to Beyond the Matrix here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next week.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.